fall. Baby, it's not mine. I chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with my co-host,
Charlotte Littlefield. Good evening, George.
Oh, Charlotte, how you doing? Everything going okay?
Everything's great. I'm so excited for this interview.
Well, we have an excellent guest with us this evening, and her name is Judith Berry Baker, and she has such a marvelous, insightful, and a loving story to tell at times. She became acquainted with Lee Harvey Oswald in New Orleans in the 60s. They fell in love, and I'm just going to bring her on right now. She's written several books. Welcome to our program, Judith Berry Baker.
Oh, thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't we give our listening audience a little bit of a background, your background, and how you met Lee and things like that. Tell us about that.
Oh, my goodness. Well, it all began, I suppose, when my grandmother died of cancer. And I was very upset about it. She was the matriarch of the family and held our family together, the Hungarian family very close. And it just seemed so horrible that she was taken from us and suffered so much. And cancer was just ravaging my family anyway. My Aunt Elsie had been cured of cancer, so-called, but she was ill and bleeding for the rest of her life from the primitive kind of treatment they had to use. And as I saw all this suffering, I just wanted to do something about it, you know. And it became a lifelong obsession, you might say, that I've just got to help people who have cancer. And that's true today. I've kept up with all the research and everything. Well, anyway, back in the 60s, in the 50s, I began my own studies of cancer. And I was also very good in science and ended up inventing various things. One of the things I invented was a new method to get magnesium out of seawater. It was an improved method over one that the Germans had done. And that took me to the International Science Fair. I met Wernher von Braun and all these people and CIA people. And I brought along the work I had done in privately in cancer research. And by then I was being sponsored by several doctors in town and also by the American Cancer Society's leaders there in the area. So I had some resources, and I was already working with wild mice, but I needed pure ones, you know, white mice. Anyway, make a long story short, I had actually finally, because of the science fair there, and because of Philip Doyle, my science seminar teacher, he was from West Point, and he was an excellent physicist, excellent scientist in his own right. And having met people up at the science fair, including Mickelson, just prior to that, a spy in World War II, I actually learned a lot about spycraft. I learned about, because he was kind of interested, he never had a daughter. And he was in radio biology. So anyway, make a long story short, I'm going to try anyway. What happened is I was invited eventually to get training at Roswell Park Memorial Institute. And why? Because through the several years between when I first began working very hard on this cancer project and then, I had actually obtained a laboratory space, got help from Bausch and Lomb to get some excellent microscopes, worked with Manatee Memorial Hospital, had two CIA-trained oncologists on board, Dr. Shively and another doctor. We have all the records for that. And they began guiding me. I also met a former friend from Notre Dame, Renier, who had moved to St. Petersburg, Florida, and he had germ-free mice. With a combination of germ-free mice and the help I got from Walter Reed Hospital, I have all the documents for all of this, and various combinations of work. I also had stuff coming in from Oak Ridge. I managed in my high school laboratory to give cancer, lung cancer, no, on top of it all, lung cancer to weanling mice in only 7 days. And nobody had done this in the most fancy labs. I had all the records, I had the proof, but I had actually surpassed anything that the doctors there could help me with. And then I learned that from Walter Reed, they told me about a meeting that was going to be held in St. Petersburg, Florida. This is the 4th annual science seminar writers group meeting to explain the greatest advances in cancer in the world at that time. So I hitchhiked across with all my goodies under my arm, you know, and I had a press pass from my high school. This is really ridiculous because nobody was let in but the most elite, absolutely elite of the researchers and, of course, the press that was interested in. For example, there was someone there from the San Francisco Inquirer, and he was the one who was writing all the science stuff up for that newspaper and so on. Well, I squeezed myself between two reporters going in as the door closed, and it was dark. And then the lights went up, and everybody was sitting down, and there I was, the only girl in the whole place, high school girl, standing with, you know, her mini skirt. No, they didn't have them then. I was wearing one of those things that made me look like a teenage bobby soxer.
Yeah,
know?
Long dress, right? Well,
yeah,
the knees.
Right.
Yeah, I remember.
Everybody else is in a suit, you know, and they're all old men, and
right.
They're all staring at me. What is she doing here?
Man, yeah. that was interesting, wasn't it? Yeah.
Well, here come the police. They were going to take me out. They're going to get rid of me. But I had an ally. There, sitting up on the stage, was Dr. God bless him, Dr. Harold Diehl, the vice president of the American Cancer Society, in charge of all the research for the American Cancer Society. Next to him was Sir Robert Robinson, who had won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. And I idolized him. I knew who he was right away. And next to him was sitting Dr. Harold Urey, from University of Chicago, and also another Nobel Prize winner. And to the right of him sat Dr. George Moore of the Roswell Park Institute. Now, they're sitting on stage with a couple other people I didn't recognize, but I had done all my homework and all. And as I looked at Dr. Diehl with an agonized face as the police came to take me away, he said, stop. He said, come here. And everybody's staring at me. And I go up the front, and I said, I have a lot of cancer research to show you. And he said, why don't you sit here with us while we finish this up, and at noon we'll look at what you have. Oh, it was wonderful, you know?
Oh, my gosh, a breakthrough there, just communication breakthrough. Yeah.
Well, he happened to be well known for sponsoring young cancer students, you know, aspiring students in cancer research. I mean, aspiring, they were 25 years old, you know what I mean, and all that. Okay, I was 17. But anyway.
But you had guts, Judith Mary Baker, didn't you? Huh?
Well,
you're
actually,
a gutsy lady.
Over there, I didn't have a way to get across the bridge. I had to skip school to go, you know. And so I exposed some thigh, and the bus driver stopped and picked me up.
Oh, man.
Long bridge.
Man, he put on the brakes. I bet he skidded 10 feet.
Well, that's what you you have to do. I didn't have to do more, so I mean, that was just one.
Boy, that's quite a story. It's alone by itself.
Well, it's
it's an amazing story.
So there I am anyway, and at noon, they're looking at my stuff. I met Dr. Deal's wife. Her arms were huge, enormous. They'd taken you see, you have ducts under your arm that drain, you know. They drain the fluids out, and when these are removed, and they often have to do that to take those glands away. She had breast cancer, both breasts removed, her arms horribly swollen, and she took a shine to me, and I just felt so sorry for her. I helped brush her hair for her, and anyway, there's Dr. Deal. He's looking at the stuff. He shows it to Dr. George Moore. They were fascinated. Now, here's the beauty of it. Dr. George Moore and Dr. Harold Deal and a third one, Dr. Alton Ochsner, were campaigning together and showing up at all these lawsuits that were being held, these trials about people getting cancer from smoking. And what I had done is I had given cancer, lung cancer, to these mice with cigarette products.
Oh, my God. That was a very sensitive area, wasn't it, then?
It was, and they were up against Dr. Moore's Roswell Park was the first hospital in America to ban cigarettes smoking, the first one. So they had a special interest in. They had to go. They went to my unit. What happened is Dr. Ochsner wasn't there. They called him, and he flew in. And three of them, plus Dr. Urey, and came to the, I think Dr. Robinson couldn't at the time, but he made up for it later. I'll tell you about that in a second. So anyway, they went to my high school. They checked all the records there. I was not allowed to be with them. A couple of doctors there with them who came in, and then also Philip Doyle, my science seminar teacher. I think I already told you I won first prize in chemistry and all that. So, I mean, they're looking at all this, and you know what they did? They closed the lab down. It was so dangerous. They recognized also that my work was very special because it wasn't contaminated by the HeLa cancer virus-laden cells. A lot of the research at that time had been contaminated because they thought they were working with a certain kind of cancer, and it was actually a contaminant of a very vigorous cancer line. Well, all my work was done without even being anywhere near any of that contamination. So, I mean, the results were just spectacular as far as they were concerned. They were really excited, but they were very concerned because any time you get cancer in just a few days, there's a virus involved. Of course, I didn't even understand that, So they closed that lab down as fast as they could. And it scared everybody at my unit at the Manatee High School so much that they when I graduated, they withheld the science prize from me because they felt like maybe I had, endangered the school, with what I had done. But at any rate, that's not the way these three felt. They were quite excited at what they saw, and Dr. Robinson said, look, I live in Buffalo, New York, because Dr. Moore said, I want to bring her there. And Dr. Ochsner says, yeah, you've got it. And they wanted to give me special training. I evidenced enough information and abilities that they knew I was ready to go, with higher training already. So Dr. Robinson actually paid for my train ticket. And for the next few days, the two stayed on for a few days and showed me how to create better lab procedures and basically on how to structure my research in better directions. I mean, that got in the papers that these two Nobel Prize winners were instructing me, how to create, better and higher standards for my lab work and all that. It was wonderful. So, okay, here I am. I'm on my way to Roswell Park. And I was assigned to work in Dr. Moore's own special light laboratory. And I'll explain why this is so important. I'm glad we have time. I think you need to see this background.
Yes, go ahead. This is important, Judith.
This part is important because I learned how to handle the SV40 monkey virus. I did that with Dr. James T. Grace in working in radiobiology. Fortunately, there is actually a newspaper article where I am photographed, and it says I'm going to be working with radiobiology. So right there is the connection there with Dr. Grace, because, of course, they have messed up the papers. Now, I went there in 1961 when they tried to find out if I had been there, even though I've got all these newspaper articles. It said they replied that I was there in 1962. They had the wrong amount of money for me, and they didn't even mention Dr. Grace. Fortunately, it does say in the newspaper article that I'm working with radiobiology, and that was fortuitous. So anyway, when I'm there, here's something we were working on. We were working with bacteriophage. Now, I don't have time to go into what bacteriophage is, but it's one of the ways we could have cured cancer decades ago. But it's cheap, it's easy, and it doesn't make a lot of money. All right? Right. So you can imagine how I feel about that, because I see people dying of horrendous side effects from chemotherapy, let alone the disease itself. And a bacteriophage wouldn't do that. Anyway, there I am in his lab, and there was a side project that all of us in Dr. Moore's lab were working on. I was there with another student. He was a grad student, and with two doctors who were working with Dr. Moore there. And the side project was to try and find a medium that would grow cancer fastest and best so that it would stay alive, because the cancers would die off in just a few rounds, and there were things missing from the formula. Well, we worked on a formula and had been actually in the progress stage for quite a while, and it would turn out in a few years to be called the RPMI 1640. That's 1,640th version. Well, I was in on the versions, earlier versions, but they were getting perfected. When I left Roswell Park at the end of that summer and began working at it's now University of St. Francis, it was St. Francis College at the time, and they had a great medical tech lab and everything, and I was set up to work there. When I went there, I had access to Roswell Park's RPMI 1640, the pre-formula. I could grow cancer faster, probably, and better, and keep it alive longer than anybody outside of that laboratory. Now, that's important because of what I'm saying. When I was sent to New Orleans, I had access to that formula, and it made the project that they were working on just massively increase in its speed and direction. Now, when I was at St. Francis, I was thinking I was going to become a nun, because the doctors told me I couldn't have children. And I thought, well, I just want to serve God and serve humanity, so I was going to become a nun. Well, I'll tell you what. My father was really against that, and in the middle of the night, he kidnapped me, threw me in the car, and took me away. And there were my scholarship money. I had lots of scholarship money. I had all that. It was all left behind. You're not going to become a nun. Yes, Dad. I mean, what can I do? He also sent me a lot of anti-Catholic literature. You see, I'd read this whole Encyclopedia Britannica when I was 16, but the problem, I'm a speed reader. But anytime I ran into something anti-Catholic, I was a Catholic and I skipped it, you know. So now I'm getting to hear about Pope Joan. I'm hearing about the Inquisitions. I'm hearing about a lot of bad things that all religions get enmeshed in, you know, whenever they get anywhere, any age on them, you start getting all these problems, you know, with these religions.
Right.
In fact, I became an atheist. I'm not one now. I've learned my lesson. I believe you have to go through an awful lot to and really seek out God. And if you seek, you shall find.
Right.
That's my opinion.
You've been through quite a bit. I know you have.
So here we are. Newspaper articles are saying this. And says, Judith, when she came back, she was assigned, it says so right in the newspapers, her assignment to make cancers more deadly. Now, it's right there in the newspapers, and for the next several years, because Senator Smathers, when he found out what happened to me, he made sure I got into the University of Florida, and relatives of mine drove me there against my father's wishes, and I entered University of Florida on a scholarship from Senator Smathers. I had scholarships all over, but I just wanted to become a nun.
Right. Okay.
I didn't want to become a nun after all the things I'd read, and I felt like if God didn't have the power to stop my father from kidnapping me, then what kind of powerful God was that, et cetera.
Right.
Little did I know that I was being maneuvered into a situation where I could become a witness to the innocence of Lee Harvey Oswald.
Right.
So now we get into 1961, because I can go into the couple years of training I had. It was University of Florida. At that time, I invented a new way to determine if you had cancer in your bloodstream, if you had active cancer. It would take 40 years before that would be reinvented. I was kicked out of cancer research because of my ethics. And I guess I'll talk about that just for a second. At one point in the research that they were doing in New Orleans, they were going to test this on prisoners. These prisoners were volunteers from Angola prison, and they were at a mental hospital where the experiments were going to be made. I had been told they had terminal illnesses, and that, you know, the cancer would, is fast acting cancer is what I was specializing in, and I will go back to that in a second. But it turned out that these people were completely healthy, and they were going to inject them with stuff that would kill them, and if it worked, they would die, and they weren't told. When I objected, I was kicked out of cancer research, and I can't tell you how frustrated and angry I have been ever since. And I've kept up with it. If they put me in a lab today, I could still do something good. And at any rate, that's what happened. I was kicked out by Ochsner for objecting to using live prisoners. To this day, my enemies say, look, she injected people with cancer up at the, you know, at the...
Well, okay, going back a little bit, you started working before that you were kicked off the project. You started working on a secret project there, and that's where you met Lee Harvey Oswald. Is that right?
Absolutely. So now, I have to say all this so that you would understand. Too many people thought, well, she couldn't have been competent. I mean, good heavens.
Sure.
You're talking about 18 years old, 19 years old, and you're telling us that she could grow cancer faster than anybody else and this kind of thing. It was true. Now, we come up to the spring of 1963, and I have invented this method to get, to discern if the cancer might be in somebody's bloodstream. That would turn out to be quite important with these prisoners. Anyway, I'm invited by Dr. Ochsner, who's been getting reports from time to time of my work. At the same time, I was working on melanoma, which they'd asked me to work on. I have actually published, presented a lecture and a presentation of my paper on melanogenesis up in Indiana before I was kidnapped. So the paper itself never got published, but the abstract did. And in that abstract, you can see I was getting materials from Roswell Park, and that I was working with melanoma at the same time that Dr. Ochsner was. Melanoma is the fastest growing cancer and one of the most deadly. And originally, their ideas were to try and kill Fidel Castro with melanoma. However, to make sure he gets such a cancer, it turned out to be very difficult without his knowledge. They wanted to kill Castro, of course, because so much was going on in New Orleans. The sugar, the bananas, the other things that were going through there, they were worried that Castro, his influence was spread throughout Central and South America and in Mexico and so on, and it would be the domino effect, and everybody was going to turn communist. Dr. Ochsner was sincerely anti-commie. Oh, my gosh. He had founded INCA. He was a co-founder with Ed Butler and others, and CIA was in on that. And INCA was the Information Council of the Americas. I mean, he was into politics. He was into anti-Castro stuff, even though he was a famous physician, and even though he was a famous oncologist. And he is so influential. We now have secret records that have come out showing that when I said that he was associated with CIA in 1963, everybody said, nope, we have the records. It says in the 50s, all that association stopped. Well, now we have the new records that have come out showing that the last face-to-face encounter that Ochsner had with the CIA was in 1962, when this project began, by the way, and that was in November or October. And then the last communication with Ochsner Clinic, which was working on this material secretly under, you know, with Ochsner, their last communication with CIA, according to CIA, was in November 1963, just as I had said. So a lot of the things that I've written in the book, Me and Lee, we now see are actually coming to pass. I mean, I didn't have the evidence before. I could just report what happened. For example, a big gun shipment, I said, had come in from Caracas, Venezuela, by boat, by ship. It was a big, I mean, we're talking about hundreds of rifles. And they said, oh, come on, we know that people brought in like four rifles, you know, but they weren't doing that stuff in 63. That was all prohibited. Well, now a new record has come out, and they said, by the way, nothing was coming in from Venezuela. Now a new secret record's come out showing that a shipment of over 700 rifles came in from Venezuela and was distributed to anti-Castro Cubans, just as I had reported. Our shipment came in and is a big part of my book, chapters 17 and 18, you'll see in my book, Me and Lee, where Lee was very involved in getting this big shipment from Caracas safely in. So what happened is this new record came out, and it confirms. But on top of that, Lee Oswald, in his address book, had written down, and they have now translated that because his handwriting is pretty sloppy. Anyway, it says Venezuela guns right in his own address.
Oh, my
address.
Gosh. You're proving to be true right on top of it, Judith.
There it was. And so that just a few weeks ago, matter of fact. So because once it's out in color, you can see that what it was. And it also said something about watcher and ring and all kinds of things. You know, cell ring. Oh, there are all different kinds of things going on, and it all fits with what I've already said in Me and Lee. Oh, and there's also another record that came out you might be interested in. I had said on page 108 in Me and Lee that Jack Ruby was a big shot. And, you know, they try to say he was just a sleazy nightclub owner and maybe a police fixer and worked maybe with Marcello somewhat. The strippers that I had gotten to know in New Orleans, they communicated that they hoped that he would take a shine to them because Jack Ruby was so important that if he took them to Las Vegas, they might make the big time. But to do so, they'd have to sleep with Jack Ruby. Well, all these things went around that Jack Ruby was homosexual, you know, and so on. And so people were not believing what I had written in Me and Lee, that, you know, they had to sleep with him to get ahead. They could go to Las Vegas and become rich and famous, you know, with strippers and all that kind of thing, or at least notorious. So out comes this new secret record. It shows that Jack Ruby, only 8 days before the assassination, was up in Vegas and had signed himself in with Mr. and Mrs., okay, with a stripper there. And
just like you said, yeah, in there.
Just as I said. And the Tropicana Motel there, which was a big, famous mafia establishment, really, he was riding around in a Rolls Royce. So he was no small potatoes, just as the girls had told me. And so, I mean, I have a lot of things in the book like that that couldn't be confirmed before. And, of course, it's just all true. So, people, I hope they will get the book, Me and Lee. All the proceeds and sales from Me and Lee go to support the conference. And, you know, we're at the November conference.
Tell us a little bit about the upcoming conference in Dallas, Julia.
Yes. That conference is going to be really historic. Now, you know, we're losing our witnesses. I mean, Jim Mars, the last major conference he attended was last November in Dallas with us. And I founded this conference because the other ones were losing steam. There was another conference. In 2013, the leader of that other conference in Dallas said that they were only going to be holding conferences once every 5 years after 2013. Oh, they changed that when I decided to found this one. All of a sudden, they are back in business, all right?
Right.
So, but they banned me. I'm not allowed to speak over there because they don't believe me, you know. Some of these people, what happened is they judged me early on because of John McAdams' stuff he put out there. For example, he put out that Mary Sherman was not, it was just an orthopedic surgeon. She wasn't a cancer researcher. He said cancer couldn't be given to mice. He said I didn't have any evidence. All I had was an ink bottle and Lee's flip-flops as evidence. I mean, it's ridiculous, the stuff he put out there. But the people, the researchers, a lot of them just jumped on and said, oh, she must be some kind of nut. And once they say these things, they will not retract. They will not say, I was wrong. They will just, you know, find anything they can to basically, these people never met me, never saw the evidence files, never spoke to any of my living witnesses, and I have a dozen of them now. No, none of that. They just continue to say, what? You mean you would go to Baker's Conference? Well, Baker's Conference is now the biggest JFK conference in the world. And we have some of the best speakers, because I will not, nobody who is speaking at that conference is going to say, let's debate whether or not Lee Harvey Oswald killed Kennedy. There's so much evidence out there that, well, we don't do that. The debate is over, my friend, after more than 50 years. Lee Oswald's innocent. I'm here to prove it. God spared my life so I can do it. So what we're having is November 17, 18, and 19 in Dallas. Just go to JFK Dallas Conference, all right?
Okay.
.com. JFK Dallas Conference.
We'll have that up for you on our site. Yeah,
Thank you so much. Of course, you're welcome. Yeah. You know, George, I'd love to have you there. I really would. We're having speakers like nobody else has because they're carefully vetted. We've had new witnesses. And some of them confirming, of course, my situation. So you're going to hear, if I read you the list, do we have time?
Yes, we do. Go ahead.
Start?
Yeah, we have it. We have time.
Okay, just one second. I can get that for you. Let's see here. All I have to do is open it.
Your conference exceeded those other conferences by far. You had a greater number of speakers. Well, you had the people that received the body up in Washington, D.C., you know,
yes,
I mean,
that's right.
And that was 2 years or so you had that. And that was so insightful to listen to those men that actually examined the body, JFK's body, when it arrived. And
we're going to have two of them come in again, Hubert Clark but I want to tell you, these two were on the other side. They're the ones who didn't know that they were guarding nothing. I mean, you know, that the body was switched.
Okay.
Now, Dennis David spoke last year. He's dead, as is poor. Oh, it breaks my heart that Jim Mars is gone too.
Oh,
so
Jim's,
we've got
great
to
guy.
Get these people. People need to hear these people. We don't know how many more years we can do this. They're all going to be dead, you know.
Right.
So yeah, we're having Phil Singer is someone nobody really knows about. He's somebody who works behind the scenes for 50 years. We have Hubert Clark and George Bud Barnum coming in, original Kennedy Honor Guard members who carried the coffin and guarded it at JFK's funeral and so on. We have Marianne Moorman Kramer, who tells me that she didn't know she's supposed to be speaking at the other conference. Well, at any rate, she'll be briefly speaking. We have Zach Shelton coming. Now, Zach is the specialist on James Files. He's interviewed him and has known him for years. He'll tell you what he thinks about Files. He's going to be speaking on Friday. James Dolan is going to be speaking about, his dad is the notorious Dallas hoodlum who worked in Dallas, knew all about Jack Ruby. And he's a, you know, we have Ed Tatro. I mean, Ed Tatro is the number one researcher. And, you know, of course, he was behind a lot of the material in 7, 8, and 9 episodes, you know, there of The Men Who Killed Kennedy. So with Rick Russo. Now, we also have Phil Nelson. He's going to be talking about LBJ's treachery, the USS Liberty, and how James Earl Ray was made a patsy. And by the way, Phil has just been wonderful. He recently wrote an essay, and it's titled Judith Vary Baker's Incredible Credentials. Because, you see, yes, he has seen some files. He has been there. He has spoken to me. He has vetted. I mean, all they had to do was meet me, but anyway. Now, then we're going to have the American media and the second assassination of John F. Kennedy, that movie, which is, it's been very hard to get it out there to the public. It is, it will make you cry when you see it. All right, that's all just for Friday.
Now, and, oh, my and, gosh.
That's I mean, great. You're talking about 31 speakers. The other side, the other organization, I'm glad they're in business. We want people to know. I don't care where they get the information from, what really happened. They have 20 speakers so far. All right, anyway, and they actually only have 2 days of events really going on. The rest of it is watching the mock trial that's going to be held in you know, by TV, and then they're going to be out. And I'm irritated. On Sunday, my friend,
right.
Not on Wednesday. Wednesday, the 22nd, is when Kennedy was shot.
Right.
We are spending a lot of money because we have to stay over. All these people have to stay over. So we can hold the true moment of silence and the real remembrance ceremony on Wednesday, the 22nd, for everybody in the plaza. Pay attention. We're going to play taps. We're going to have music. We're going to have American flags passed out. We're going to tell people that Lee Oswald was innocent, and we're going to tell them that John F. Kennedy needs justice. We're doing this on the 22nd at, on the Grassy Knoll, at, starting at about 11:30 until 2:30, because we want people to be there and to recognize the 22nd as the date that Kennedy was shot, and it was, and they'll be there. Those people will be there at that time. Now, the other group is actually holding a remembrance ceremony and moment of silence on Sunday.
Okay.
They're doing it because it's very convenient and cheap to do it that way. But it can confuse people. So we're purists. That is, we're really careful about getting everything accurate, and that even goes to so far as that we will be there Wednesday, even though it's not going to be cheap. It isn't for us to do that. So here we are on Saturday, November 18th. David Denton is going to talk about the July batch of released secret records. By November, we will know. Also, we'll be speaking about the records released in October. So people need to come and hear this. We've got it all set up. We'll be analyzing, and we'll tell you what those secret files are about, if anything's left there that's worth anything. Larry Schnapp will be speaking on the Kappa's mock trial. And Randy Benson, he will be having selected film clips from the mock trial. So nobody's going to miss the mock trial just because they're at our conference. They're going to get the highlights from the lawyers who are defending Lee Oswald over there and in Houston, and we think that we're going to get the best that way. That's what we're about. Okay, then we have Andrew Craig is coming in, connecting the dots to today, 2017's JFK secret records, and 2018's 50th on RFK and MLK. Andy is one of the honest, and there aren't that many, cannot be bought journalists in D.C., and he's respected. I'll be speaking then, and I have gotten threats. I have been told somebody needs to arrest me, because I will be speaking on Saturday. Here's the real Lee Harvey Oswald, and how Michael and Ruth Payne betrayed him. I've got stuff that could send them to prison. I'm not kidding. And somebody doesn't like me for it. I should not mention the things that have happened, but privately I will. Now, then we have a lunch. Then we have something wonderful happening on Saturday, because the HSCA, you know, that's the House Select Committee on Assassinations, they got together and they came up with the conclusion that Lee Oswald did not act alone. Well, he didn't act at all, but at least they admitted that there was another shooter. And we had Dr. Cyril Wecht at that time, who was the only dissenting a pathologist and a coroner who, at way back then, argued that the magic bullet was impossible, and he is still with us. So we have the original people. We have three of them. We have Bob Grodin, we have Dr. Cyril Wecht, and we have Robert Tannenbaum, who is the deputy chief counsel. They're all going to be speaking about the HSCA and how they were fooled, and how there are so many files that we're not allowed to see, and how they were hoodwinked. And they all know that Lee Oswald was innocent. So this is probably the last opportunity for these men, these HSCA original members, to be together. So Bob Grodin especially is going to get a special award, a lifetime award from David Denton from the JFK Historical Group for his work. Bob has lost his vision in one eye, and he's had several strokes. We may never, it's just sad. We're losing these people. And so Bob will be there speaking. Dr. Wecht will be there, and then Robert Tannenbaum. He was once, these are great guys. Tannenbaum was actually elected, mayor of, over there in California, of his city. Now, then we're going to have Dick Russell coming in. Now, he's the one who wrote The Man Who Knew Too Much. And he's going to be speaking on the government's lies about the Kennedy assassination and JFK's vision of a nuclear-free world. Dick Russell is probably one of the most famous authors who's spoken so much on the Kennedy assassination and has brought in information about Richard Case Nagel, showing that he actually was carrying Heidel cards and a card with Lee Harvey Oswald's name on it. He was a CIA guy. So we have living witness in Dick Russell about that Lee Oswald was part of a government, Lee called the Heidel thing a government project. All right, then we're going to have a speaker's dinner, and we're going to have some great awards there. But one of them is I'm going to present the Down the Toilet Award to the History Channel for their absurd and ridiculous education.
Oh, yeah, man.
It's an actual little toilet that we...
Oh, okay. Oh, man, that's great. Judith, you have come up with very inventive, imaginative things. You know that?
Well, we're going to have special music by St. John Hunt and David Neal. David Neal is the one who wrote Oswald Didn't Do It. You can hear it online. It's really good, on YouTube. Well, then we're going to have, that evening, we're going to have, for those who can't go to this special dinner, the movie Executive Action. That movie was made 10 years after the assassination with great actors in it. Okay, Burt Lancaster, Robert Ryan, Will Greer, and it was absolutely quashed. It was removed from theaters. They did not want it. It shows how it looks like the government plus, rich oilmen and so on killed Kennedy. Pretty darn good, and it's been released finally to the public. Okay, then Sunday's coming. We're going to have, I'm going to be speaking again on the new secret records in Mexico City, the mission of Lee Harvey Oswald, that he really did go to Mexico City, as I've said all along, and we now have more proof of that in the released records, which, by the way, they show that Lee did go to Mexico City, and then they've got all these rewritten records on top of it, trying to remove that information. We're going to have Grover Proctor. He's the one that did the rally call, Lee Oswald's emergency call to the CIA. They pulled the plug on that so that call did not get through. He's just done wonderful research. We're going to have Jeffrey Holmes, who's going to tell us all about New Orleans Underground. Victoria Salzer, that's Victoria Hall Salzer, is one of my witnesses who saw Lee Oswald all the time over at Dr. Mary Sherman's house or apartment, because she lived there too. And by the way, we have another, she doesn't want to speak. I will be talking about her. She's too afraid. But this witness, and I'll give her name at the conference, and that's all right with her, she saw Lee Oswald so many times at my apartment that she thought he lived there. So,
Right. Well, yeah. Getting back to that New Orleans, then you were working on a secret project to develop a cancer virus that was going to be used to assassinate Castro, right? But
right. I basically finished most of Friday, Saturday, Sunday. There.
Go ahead.
So there are a few more speakers like St. John Hunt and Dr. Fetzer and Larry Rivera. But yes, so I am now in New Orleans, and I was given this ticket. Dr. Oxnard called and said, we want you, you know, we've got a great position for you with Dr. Mary Sherman. You'll be doing an internship with her. And how do you feel about it? I said, wonderful. He said, great. See you. And then he said at the end, when I said, I'd love to be there, then he said, see you around the middle of May, and hung up. And I didn't know where he called from. I couldn't call him back. When I finally tried to reach him, it turned out he had left for Central America. But he sent a ticket. So when I came, because we were in a trimester system instead of the semester system, he didn't realize that I was already out of school. I couldn't go home. I already told you how my dad felt about me going to college. You know, he tried to keep me to run his business and wouldn't let me go to school. So I couldn't go home to my parents. I had to go somewhere. So I came to New Orleans early, a couple of weeks early. And they weren't there. I thought, oh, they're going to wine and dine me. I'm going to meet all these famous and wonderful researchers. I'm going to meet Dr. Sherman. They were all out of town.
Oh,
and
my
there
gosh.
I arrive. I am 19 years old. Get off the bus. The first thing I hear is a gunshot. Boom.
Oh, my God.
No, nobody
just random shootings. Man.
Yeah. And I tried to walk to the Y from the bus station because they said, and the guy started following me. So I came back. I had to get a cab. I was too scared. Got there, middle of the night. I mean, it's middle of the morning, I should say, early in the morning, about 3 in the morning. And some sleepy person at the desk said, you're not on this list. I said, what? Of course I am. I'm supposed to check in. She said, when? I said, 2 weeks from now. See how I was so naive. Said, well, we don't have any record of you checking in now. You have to pay your own way until then, you know? Oh, boy, what am I going to do? I had $42. That's $420 in today's money, but it still isn't that much if you're on your own and you don't know what to do.
Exactly.
And you've got 2 weeks, okay, before anybody's going to come back and fill out the papers. So I said, what do you have? What's your cheapest room? And she said, well, we have one room where we can squeeze one more person in, she said. So in I go, and it's early in the morning, and they all rush to the door. Oh
my God.
Oh, who are you? They were looking for a stripper who was still out, and there had been raids that night. And she would be coming in that morning, wrapped only in newspapers.
My gosh. Judith.
With almost nothing on.
What were the headlines, I wonder, on the newspaper?
Yeah. Well, she was wrapping. She was hiding in telephone booths and everything. She'd run from booth to booth or whatever. Anyway, she finally made it back to the Y. And so help me, that's all she was wearing were pasties and newspapers, okay? So she was in trouble, but she did not get arrested. And so there I am with two strippers, one naked, I saw naked run away, and a Playboy bunny trainee and a real tough waitress who worked way out of town, and I got tired of the long commute, said she was quitting. That is very important.
Oh, my gosh.
How much time do we have left? Because I want to tell you what
we have about 10 minutes, a little less than 10 minutes.
All right. There's so much I'd like to tell you. But here's the basic part. When I was running around I saw more of real low life and vomiting and attempted rapes and you name it in just a few days with these people. people hitting other people over the head with bottles of whiskey and so on. New Orleans is a wonderful place, but not if you're in that group of people, not necessarily. So I got to see the back rooms where the strippers were and their sad stories and how most of them were locked in contracts they couldn't get out of, you know, and most of their money went to their, well, I could call them Johns, couldn't I? Okay, anyway, Something had to be done. I'm going, meanwhile, every day to the post office. I got a job taking this waitress's place temporary, just for 2 or 3 hours in the morning when they had a morning rush. They didn't want me all day because, you know, they didn't need me. They were trying to find somebody full-time that had real experience. But just for the time being, I was taking this long drive out to the Royal Castle. Little did I know that this Royal Castle was filled with Bobby Kennedy's people surveilling Carlos Marcello.
My gosh.
Whose town and country was, you could see it from, easily see them coming and going from the Royal Castle. It was open 24 hours, you see. And Lee, when he met me at the post office. I was going to the post office every day because I was engaged to a genius, 186 IQ, tall, looked like Superman with his glasses off. This was the most horrible mistake of my life. I had mixed up sex with love. Never do that, folks. I mean, real love I found with Lee Oswald. Sex I found with Robert Baker, okay? Right. The joys of sex I'm confused with the joys of real love.
Right.
Don't get me wrong. Lee Oswald was an excellent lover, and those who try to claim he was not, they should see what it says in Patricia Johnson McMillan's book, which is Marina and Lee, where she, it says that Ruth Payne, was there at the house, you know, when she dropped off Marina at 4905 magazine, there, right there in New Orleans, and that he had made love to Marina 3 times that night. You can't do that if you're in, you know.
Right.
Lee Oswald had it, had the goods.
And but you had a special love because you had things in common. And
we had so much, we had terrible mothers.
Yeah.
We had so much in common, and I'll be talking about that in New Orleans. You see, on the 20th and 21st, I'm going to be in New Orleans, and I want people to come to this seminar. They're going to learn a lot. I'm going to show everything that's in the book, show what the real Lee Oswald was like, show what the pains were like. And on top of that, we'll be talking about cancer. We're going to do that on Friday, the 20th, at the Crown Plaza Hotel. And it's $45 to go to the seminar. But for $100, you get seminar, if you want to go, and a bus trip on the 21st. I'm telling you, this is what's really, really important. It's never been done, and it won't do it again. But we're going to be filmed for 9 hours. We're going to go to every site, the safe houses, the Oxners, this, that, and the other, Garrison's things, what Marcello was, all the sites that were connected with the Cancer Research, the secret project that we were engaged in there to try and kill Castro. It's all going to be there. And by the way, Armand St. Martin, you know, he's a wonderful singer and entertainer. He's going to be on board that bus with his wife. I'm just so thrilled. But 9 hours. They have tours for $85 that last 3 hours in New Orleans. This is for 9 hours, and then we're going to have a nice dinner together. We're going to eat also lunch where Lee and I did. Lee and I fell in love. This was a man who's been so demonized, so dehumanized. And you need to know who this wonderful man really was. Now, he couldn't be friendly and make friends when he was on assignments. I mean, if you're supposed to do this, that, and the other for the CIA or the FBI, and somebody new wants to come in your life and say, hey, let's go to lunch, you can't say, look, I'm on an assignment with the CIA. So he couldn't be friendly and make new friends. People don't understand this, because you'll see the CIA and FBI again and again. They're interviewing people, say, no, he was sullen, he wouldn't make friends, he kept to himself, he had to. But when you got there, know the real man. Look at all those photos of Lee. You'll see his arms are around women's arms around him. He was a wonderful guy, and I'm going to show who he really was. So here I am in New Orleans. I think I'm in love with this guy who might come and marry me, and I'm angry because the man did not write, and he promised he would. But now, get this. Every morning at 10 o'clock, I was going there. Lee Oswald shows up, and we do believe that he was there, sent there to get me out of this tangle with these strippers and so on, because I was an asset. I was somebody they needed. I could grow cancer faster, as I said, than anybody. And I had the formula. I had that RPMI 1640 precursor formula that nobody else had. That's what they really were interested in, and they were interested in my blood test. So for all those reasons, and because I knew how to grow cancer so fast, they could recognize the kinds of cancer they were after. They wanted to kill Castro with a galloping lung cancer. They found a way that they could do it. I talk about all of that. Castro smoked cigars. Nobody would be to blame. Castro had aimed his nuclear weapons at my family and at everybody I knew in Florida. Lee Oswald, and I'll talk about that if we ever get another chance, he thought I was CIA and FBI because I'd known Knute Nicholson, this CIA agent, as I told you. I had all these connections. When I was at the University of Florida, my friends were anti-Castro people, and I had dated Tony Lopez Risquet. His father was the finance minister of Cuba under Castro. And I talked so knowledgeably. Lee really thought I was part of that. And because I was working at Royal Castle, only there 2 hours, he thought I must be a courier for Bobby Kennedy, getting things that, because they didn't have cell phones back then, that I was taking information that they gathered every night in the morning back into New Orleans. How would he know? Here I was writing a letter, it looked like, to Robert A. Baker at Eglin Air Force Base, because I sent one letter that day when he met me. And that letter said it was from R. Rourke. It looked like R, but the R was cursive, and it could have been an A. As far as Lee knew, I was mailing a letter from Alexander Rourke, who was a CIA asset, to Robert A. Baker at Eglin Air Force Base, who was an FBI agent. He knew both of those people. Actually, Robert A. Baker was just my fiancé. And the R. Rourke up there, yeah, like an A. Rourke, that man, Robert told me, don't put your own name, put that name on there so my parents won't know we're going to elope. So Lee was fooled, and he and David Ferry told me a lot of things about the secret side of the project, so that when Oxler came back, he had no choice but to put me on the secret side. That's how that happened.
Oh, man. We've got about two minutes left. Judith, what would be some of your final comments?
Well, the truth is coming out. Most people now, if they just spend an hour or two on the Internet, and they know about fake news now. They know that the government lies. Anybody who speaks knowledgeably about the Kennedy assassination and then says Oswald did it is a government plant, is a paid voice, is a troll. I'm telling you, read me and Lee, read JFK and The Unspeakable, and read Dr. Mary's Monkey. Those three books will give you everything you need to know about the lies, about the deceptions, and about the truth.
Right. Thank you. Charlotte, what would be some of your final comments here before we say goodbye?
I would say thank you for including me. I've had a most riveting hour. It was a pleasure to listen and to learn so much. Have a good success at your conferences and your get-togethers.
Oh, yeah, the get-together in New Orleans, by the way, that will be Saturday and Sunday, October 2021st, at the Crown Plaza Hotel out at the airport. And you can call them and get a special rate at the hotel. Just use the code LHZ.
Okay, we'll put that up also on the site and add that
thank
along
you
with the JFK. But thank you so very much for being with us this evening, Judith Ferry Baker. And you're really good for your word, I'll say that. You're a great lady, too.
Well, God bless you. I just want to help people. I love people, and I'm grateful that I had an opportunity to speak with you today.
You've made a lot of sacrifices, and we value your work.
My pleasure.
Yeah, I can't even live, you know, in the United States. I have to move every 90 days. I live overseas.
Right.
10 years now.
Well, thank you very much, Judith. Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.